We can do no better than to turn to the analysis of our intellectual ancestors, for none will put the issue so bluntly and yet so lyrically as did the old Right author and editor Garrett Garrett when he wrote in 1951, quote, "Among the mechanisms on the government's panel board now is a dial marked war. It may be set to increase or decrease the tempo of military expenditures as the planners decide that what the economy needs is a little more inflation or a little less, but of course, never any deflation." Now this, of course, was the basis of the old Right's opposition to U.S. entry into the Second World War, the credo of a whole generation of American conservatives who rallied around the old America First Committee and opposed the post-war internationalist foreign policy that an interventionist foreign policy would have to mean the centralization and expansion of state power at home. From Garrett Garrett to John T. Flynn, from Frank Shadarov to Murray N. Rothbard, the old Right opposed the policy that made us the guardian of Europe, the bully of the Western Hemisphere, and eventually entangled us in a debilitating and humiliating land war in Asia. But Garrett's analysis raises an important question. Whose hand is setting the mechanisms on the government's control board? For some insight into this vital question, let us turn now to the old Right poet, Robinson Jeffers. In his great poem, Shiva, written in 1938, he warns us that, quote, "There is a hawk that is picking the birds out of our sky. She has killed the pigeons of peace and security. She has taken confidence from nations and men. She is hunting the lonely heron of liberty. She loads the arts with nonsense. She is very cunning. Science with dreams and the state with powers to catch them at last. Nothing will escape her at last, flying nor running. This is the hawk that picks out the star's eyes. This is the only hunter that will ever catch the wild swan. The prey on which she will take last is the white wild swan of the beauty of things. Then she will be left alone, pure destruction, achieved and supreme, empty darkness under the death tent wings. She will build a nest of a swan's bones and hatch a new breed, hang new heavens with new birds. All will be renewed." End quote. All will be renewed in the new world order. Jeffers saw it coming very early on. This theme of organized evil, self-conscious, systematic, and hunting the lonely heron of liberty is the theme of many of his poems, starting in the immediate pre-war period when it became all too apparent that we were going to be pushed into war if we didn't go willingly. That is the Second World War. In today's political atmosphere, such talk is considered evidence of extremism, be that as it may. Patriots must insist on asking a perfectly legitimate and logical question, qui bono? Who benefits? Who profits from war? That a corrupt and even treasonous elite is sacrificing our best warriors on the altar of their own greed and grandiosity is a theme that dates back to the beginning of this century, a suspicion that energized much of the opposition to the annexation of the Philippines, the conquest of Puerto Rico, and the acquisition of an American overseas empire at the turn of the century. In opposing U.S. entry into the First World War, Representative James L. Sladen, a Texas Democrat, declared that he suspected, quote, "a conspiracy to force our country into a war with Germany," end quote. He attacked what he called the great and influential lobby operating about the halls of Congress and in the press, whose purpose was not only to feed the maw of the war makers, but also to deploy our enlarged forces in Europe. Now here Sladen is expressing the main theme of anti-imperialism first raised in the battle against annexation of the Philippines, and that is that a warmongering and profiteering elite, motivated by greed and a treasonous devotion to Great Britain, was conspiring to involve us in the intrigues of Europe and get us into the war. This concept, first articulated by the anti-imperialist movement of the 1890s, was a favorite populist theme that developed and grew stronger with the years, carrying over into the isolationist resistance to World War I and permeating the rhetoric of non-interventionist factions within both major parties. Sladen reminded his audience of the sound advice of George Washington and wondered if they had forgotten the timeless wisdom of the founders. It seemed to him that they had forgotten. Otherwise, they would have resisted the efforts of the enemies of peace with their, what he called, exhaustless resources to militarize the country. Okay, now, that war is the stratagem of what he called the great commercial interests to increase their power and profit margins and induce an artificial prosperity was an analysis updated and refined by John T. Flynn, a founding father of the old right. In his great and now sadly out of print book, As We Go Marching, Flynn foresaw a monstrously overgrown bureaucratic state. Quote, interfering in the affairs of the state and cities, taking part in the management of industry and finance, agriculture, assuming the role of a great national banker and investor, borrowing billions every year and spending them on all sorts of projects, marshaling great armies and navies at crushing costs to support the industry of war and preparation for war, which will become our greatest industry. And adding to all this, the most romantic adventures in global planning, regeneration, and domination, all to be done under the authority of a powerfully centralized government, end quote. Flynn saw the welfare warfare state as an integrated system, with war and inflationary bank credit fueling the engine of tyranny. And there is no doubt that he knew who and what he was fighting. Writing in 1937, he noted that, quote, during the World War, that is the First World War, prior to our own entrance into it, every rumor of peace overtures sent a thrill of fright through a Wall Street. In December of 1916, just before Germany made that last fatal bid for peace as a prelude to the final submarine campaign of terror, the event was thus reported in the New York Times Analyst, quote, Tuesday, 1/2 hour before opening time, news of Germany's move for peace leaked out. It conjured up in the minds of traders prospects as terrifying as a declaration of war, end quote. With this in mind, Flynn continues, we can see how futile would be any conference to call an end to the armaments race, end quote. In The Love and the Hate, the poet Jeffers tells us the tale of a slain soldier returned from the dead to confront his family. He haunts his parents for being, quote, the decent and loyal people of America, caught by their own loyalty, fouled, gouged, and bled to feed the power hunger of the politicians and make trick fortunes for swindlers and collaborators, end quote. Who are these swindlers? It is government that makes war, first of all, against its own citizens and all too often against each other, that is, against other governments. But if we strip away the facade of the state and get a look at the real actors in this age-old bloody drama, what stands revealed is the money power. War and preparations for war hurt a great many people, but a very few are enriched. The beneficiaries are, first of all, the central banks that make enormous profits off the money they loan to these governments. Keeping the Austrian critique of central banking in mind, it is therefore the investment bankers who are virtually dependent on doing business in government bonds who are the makers of these trick fortunes. It is the money power that profits the most from war, and as we shall see, it is they who have brought us virtually every major war of the 20th century. Now, the second tier of war profiteers includes the great manufacturing interests, especially the weapons makers. There was a time when these interests were careful to mask their support for war and policies that must lead to war, but today they boldly advance their agenda, and not only in the halls of Congress, pouring their ill-gotten gains into making militarism more popular. This gang has sunk large sums into conservative think tanks, magazines, and other media in an ongoing attempt to shape public opinion. Now that the Cold War is over, they are going all out, and their ads have been appearing regularly in the major media, especially in those periodicals that have most slavishly followed their line down through the years. On the right, the prime example is National Review magazine. For example, take the July 31st, 1995 issue, billed on the cover as a special defense and technology issue. The contents are an article by Maggie Thatcher declaring that, quote, America must be number one, end quote, an editorial pushing something called Atlanticism as opposed to Americanism, but even more dramatic is the two-page spread for the Raytheon Corporation that says it all, and in far fewer words. Next to a photo of a black woman hugging her soldier son, no doubt returned from some mission on behalf of a New World Order, the copy reads, quote, she spends her nights wondering, is he alive? Is he safe? Is he afraid? Is he still the little boy who asked me to protect him from the monsters under the bed? And not until he is safely in her arms again does she dare whisper, welcome home, my baby, end quote. Now, only after prolonged staring at this advertorial does one realize with growing horror that it is meant to mimic the form of poetry. Surrounded by plenty of expensive white space, this ode to empire is followed by a word from our sponsor, quote, as long as there are loved ones to protect, we think national defense should be a top priority, unquote. McDonnell Douglas takes a less artsy, more hard-headed approach. A drawing of a C-17 transport plane landing on some foreign runway under a brooding electric purple sky. Quote, a world crisis doesn't care much about time, location, or the length of its runway, reads the headline. No siree, the body copy continues. These international crises have a bad track record. They give us no consideration for their location, and they care even less about convenient access. That's why America has the C-17, the only wide-body airlifter that can deliver American help to small, hard-to-reach airfields anywhere in the world. So go ahead. Let a world crisis be inconsiderate. We're ready. Ready, that is, to reap enormous profits from a foreign policy that demands the capacity to police the four corners of the globe. I might add that the same ads appear regularly in The New Republic, founded as the voice of left liberal interventionism and financed in the beginning by the Morgan banking interests, TNR has played a major role in cheerleading the war plans of the power elite from World War I to Clinton's foray into the Bosnian quagmire. The money power has both sides of the political system covered, just as it dominates both major parties. Finally, we get to the third tier of war profiteers, which is the general population, the little people who benefit from the initial results of the war boom. But this phony economic boom is an illusion, built as it is on debt, confiscatory taxation, and inflationary bank credit. In the end, it is the little people who lose their piddling jobs and their savings in the inevitable bursting of the inflationary bubble. In the meantime, their support is essential to the war plans of the elite, and they are the main targets of the vast propaganda machine employed by the money power to justify and even prettify their program of mass murder in the pursuit of power and profit. But internationalism is in no sense a policy forged from below. The people, in their wisdom, are invariably reluctant to involve themselves or their children in foreign squabbles. Americans have to be continually reminded that it is their sacred duty to guarantee the borders of every aspiring Balkan republic that can come up with a coat of arms and a currency that isn't worth the paper it's printed on. War greases the wheels of the plutocracy. It is the smoke and flames belched forth by the vast apparatus of state capitalism, a periodic explosion of the violence that is the essence of the whole rotten system. But war is a conspiracy of lies, not an historical necessity. It is brought about by conscious design, and not the work of unconscious historical forces, which is why the Marxists are wrong, among other reasons. If we look at the history of this monstrous evil in modern times, we can identify specific individuals and institutions, and not faceless abstractions, as the chief sponsors of the war party in America. Now, in a soon-to-be-published book, Wall Street Banks and American Foreign Policy, the late, great Murray N. Rothbard traced the money power's influence over U.S. foreign policy all the way back to the 1890s, when President Grover Cleveland was in his second term of office. For it was then that the foreign policy of the founders was abandoned and America set off on a new course of empire. Quote, at the heart of a new policy were America's leading bankers, eager to use the country's growing economic strength to subsidize and force feed export markets and investment outlets that they would finance, as well as to guarantee third world government bonds, end quote. From U.S. intervention in Nicaragua and Panama, where the U.S. government was the instrument of would-be canal builders, to Santo Domingo, where American imperialism served the interests of the Santo Domingo Improvement Company, quote-unquote, the creation of the New York bankers, Rothbard traces the ignoble history of the money power and its penchant for war. Under Teddy Roosevelt, a Morgan tool, the U.S. launched an imperialist campaign in Asia and made its presence felt in the fight for the division of China into economic spheres of influence. Seen through the lens of economic history, the story of how the U.S. was dragged into two world wars in spite of itself begins to make perfect sense. Battered by competition with the rising Rockefeller clan, the financial empire of J.P. Morgan and Company found a new lease on life when the Great War broke out in Europe. Well-connected in British banking circles, particularly with the House of Rothschild, J.P. Morgan and Company became the fiscal agent of the British and French governments, underwriting their bonds in the U.S. and launching an unprecedented propaganda campaign to drag the U.S. into the war on the side of Great Britain. Alongside the munitions makers, the upper crust Anglophiles, and the professional chest beaters in this great war to end all wars were, of course, the liberal intellectuals of the New Republic, a magazine founded by Morgan partner Willard Strait and his wife, Dorothy Whitney, the heiress. Now, Rothbard makes the important point that the massive U.S. loans to the Allies and the entire U.S. war effort would not have been possible under the relatively hard money gold standard system that existed before 1914. It was only after the establishment of the Federal Reserve System that enabled the bankers to inflate money and credit, finance massive loans, and run up huge deficits while the U.S. was at war. This was the key development in the evolution of the welfare warfare state, the linchpin of a whole system and the outcome of a carefully planned and executed campaign to formalize the monopoly of the money power and secure its hegemony over the whole of American society. It also made possible the extension of that power internationally. Looked at through the lens of economic history, the major wars of the 20th century have been the result of a power grab by this or that economic grouping, whether it be the Morgan interests, the Rockefeller World Empire or some other international robber baron who thinks of the armed forces as his own private security firm whose purpose it is to protect corporate profits everywhere in the world. We have already seen how the Morgan interests led us into the First World War. In the period leading up to the American entry into the Second World War, the War Party was an alliance of the pro-British Morgan interests alongside the rising Rockefellers, who pushed hard for war with Japan. The Morgans were ever at the beck and call of their British masters. The Rockefellers, on the other hand, saw Japan as a competitor in the vast China market for oil. As Rothbard puts it, quote, World War II might therefore be considered from one point of view as a coalition war. The Morgans got their war in Europe, the Rockefellers theirs in Asia, end quote. Now, in the post-war period, the balance of power shifted from the House of Morgan, which was heavily invested in railroads and other declining industries, to the House of Rockefeller. Since that time, every major U.S. military intervention has had a corporate or personal connection to the Rockefeller interests. The 1951 overthrow of Mohammad Mossadegh into Iran directly benefited big American oil companies owned and operated by the Rockefellers. In Guatemala in 1953, the CIA overthrew the regime to fill the coffers of the United Fruit Company, a wholly owned subsidiary of the Manhattan money power. When LBJ mobilized Wall Street in support of escalating the Vietnam War, David Rockefeller joined 19 other prominent businessmen, bankers, and top corporate lawyers in signing his name to an open letter in support. And of course, we cannot overlook the enormous influence of Henry Kissinger, a major architect of the Vietnam debacle, and for more than a decade, Nelson Rockefeller's foreign policy advisor. And of course, the most recent crusade to make the world safe for the Rockefellers was the Gulf War, in which the elite openly proclaimed that this was a war for oil, Rockefeller oil. As we are led down the path to yet another intervention in Europe in order to defend the make-believe nation of Bosnia and Herzegovina, the war lobby enjoys many advantages. Almost unlimited financial resources, a sympathetic, if not wholly owned and operated mass media, and a lock on the intelligentsia. On the other hand, they do not have the people with them. Polls show that the overwhelming majority of Americans oppose sending troops into the Balkans, and it is going to take a propaganda campaign of massive proportions to persuade them otherwise. Furthermore, the opposition is stirring. A great new anti-war movement of the right is about to take center stage. Only it won't be led by Abby Hoffman and the Trotskyites, but by staunch conservatives such as freshman Republican Mark Newman of Wisconsin, who attached an amendment to the Defense Appropriations Bill that would have prohibited the president from sending U.S. troops to Bosnia to enforce a phony peace agreement without congressional approval. The amendment passed the House but was deleted by the Senate. For his crime against the bipartisan policy of global interventionism, Newman was called up on the carpet by Newt and stripped of his key position on the National Security Subcommittee of the powerful House Appropriations Committee. This provoked an all-out rebellion by the GOP freshmen, who went to Gingrich and demanded an explanation. The Newtster backed down, gave Newman two plum committee appointments, without restoring him to a seat on the vital National Security Subcommittee, by the way, and generally bent over backwards to keep the rebels from going public with their anti-war protest. Mark Newman is a hero, but he is fighting against an establishment that has long controlled the foreign policy of this country, and that seems determined to involve us in yet another European war. What we are up against is this. Newman tells the story of how, after his Bosnian amendment passed the House, he was contacted by military contractors who made it plain that he would have a tough road to hoe when it came time to raise money for his next campaign. If the Mark Newmans of this world are dependent on military contractors to get reelected, then the Republic is doomed. Mark Newman is fighting to put America first, and he can't do it without your support. The great war-making industry, in league with foreign lobbyists and the Manhattan money power, have targeted Newman and his anti-war freshmen for political destruction. Pat Buchanan dared to oppose the Gulf War, and for that he has earned the undying enmity of the Manhattan money power, whose hirelings have been smearing him ever since. Today, a soldier named Michael New is refusing to wear the blue helmet of the UN in a so-called peacekeeping mission in Macedonia. Tomorrow, how many enlisted men will refuse to fight and die for the new world order? What is needed is a new peace movement. Now that the left has turned interventionist and the old peace groups have withered on the vine, a movement to defend Mark Newman, Pat Buchanan, Michael New, a counterweight to the foreign lobbyists and the multinational corporations, a lobby to put America first. The very existence of such a voice, raised against the internationalist consensus, would strike a mighty blow for the cause of peace and liberty. If and when the president sends 25,000 troops to Bosnia, a peace movement of the right will not have to be created. It will arise all by itself and on a massive scale. The old right is back, my friends, and what is needed is a new America First Committee to carry on and redeem the heritage of the old. Whether such a new movement succeeds or fails, whether it evolves into something greater, a more generalized rebellion against the welfare warfare state, or whether it is diverted and sputters out, is a question of the proper leadership. It is no longer enough to comment from the sidelines, to merely comment on the passing scene. We must act to stop the war plans of the power elite. We must organize in every state, in every congressional district, in every city and town and hamlet, and let the voice of America First, the voice of an authentic American nationalism, be heard. Thank you.